And I'm supposed to talk after that. Hello. It's just so beautiful to be here in Enkyo's wonderful place. And I thank you so much. Do you feel the power of this room, the energy of this room? The warmth, the humor? Boy. So, when I was asked to give a talk, I threw a few words together as a title. Some of them are not even correct. Justice technically is not a Buddhist term. There are reasons for that. Justice has to do with competing claims and an adjudicator. And this is not the Buddhist political or ethical model. The Buddhist political and ethical model, and they are one, is an absolute ruler under the Dhamma, so that the Dhamma flows through the kingdom unimpeded, completely, and needs are met, and things are cared for, and things flourish. So, what I was thinking about, and that's the problem I was thinking, was this question of the world. Yeah. I've been doing Theravada practice since 2003, and in Cambodia, of course, we do Theravada practice because it's a Theravada country and we're working with dying people, and the last thing dying people need is something strange. So over the years, between Vipassana meditation and learning to teach inside the Theravada, Cambodian Theravada tradition, I've gone off the ranch, is what somebody said to me when I said I wanted to study with him, because this was my year off. He said, well, you spend summer at Tassajara first. You've been off the range a long time. So, here's the range. Yeah. And it really feels wonderful. But I have no idea what to say. So I think what I'd like to do, since we are not known to each other, and since there's such strong practice, is just, if it's okay, turn it over to questions. Any questions whatsoever. If you want me to tell you a few words about the work in Cambodia first, I'm happy to do that. Some of you, well, Enkyo's heard this story before, maybe nobody else. In 1998, I was seconded to Cambodia to look at two things. Medical care for the poor, which I'd already been done some work on, and how Buddhism could help the poor. And they came together around the question of AIDS, because it was the fastest growing epidemic in the world at the time. And I was running around with Mary Knoll. Do people know who Mary Knoll are? Yeah, they're the grassroots end of Catholicism, and they wrote the book on doing things from the ground up. So I was running around with them, and I happened to be chanting with someone who was dying. And his mother said to me, that that was really important, she said. He believes he has AIDS because of his karma. And we don't have money for the monks. So he's been terrified that his next life would be worse. And I thought, okay. In this whole huge picture of, you know, a blossoming AIDS epidemic and no medicine, this was one place I was actually qualified to do something. So the job of the project has always been to help people get it, that they are at the very heart of the Buddha's compassion. And we kind of do that by any means necessary. And over the years, the means have gotten more and more sophisticated. And now my staff does traditional Cambodian chanting, a beautiful, beautiful vernacular form of chanting that tells stories from the life of the Buddha. And it's designed to bring up small, strong emotions, strong painful emotion, and process it. It's called smol. And when I try to do it, it sounds like someone's torturing a cat. But when my staff do it, it's really quite extraordinary. They studied with a very fine teacher for a few years. It'll tell stories, for instance, about how when the Buddha got enlightened and went back to the palace, and his wife wouldn't see him because she was so hurt and upset and angry. So he goes into her, and she gives voice to all of her complaints. You know, it's all kinds of stories. So they do that. And we do Reiki. My staff are Reiki masters. We do healing touch. We give out necessities. But mostly, the job is to love people. Yeah. And sometimes that takes, the form of gifts, and sometimes it's, social work referrals, and sometimes it's chanting, and sometimes it's Reiki. And sometimes it's giving food in the prisons, and sometimes it's building people's houses. We've done a lot of things over the years. Sometimes it's renovating the mortuary in a hospital and paying for cremations for the destitute, because otherwise they would be just buried in the field like leftover garbage. Yeah. So over the years, we've done this range of things. And until 2010, things were gradually improving. And Cambodia became this incredible success story about AIDS. And then the government took over. And the money that was going to medicines and care started to go to Lexuses and villas. And it's been harder and harder ever since. And besides, everybody knows that AIDS isn't interesting anymore. Yeah. So we've been doing that. We're in our 16th year. I'm away. If the project is going to continue, it has to be able to continue without me, because I'm 71 and I get tired easily and my memory is really bad and all these things happen. What else? But it's still the same task. It's helping people get it, that the Buddha is present for them. Now, I know that in Zen we talk about being the Buddha, but that's too big a reach for people who feel that they are completely outside the structure. Just think about neoliberal economics and the way that that blames the poor and the way the poor internalize that. And you'll know, I'm sure you know exactly what I mean. So that's kind of what we do, and I'm away. And we may be able to continue and we may not. Organizations are folding all around us, and we've had a very good run. But we're trying to, they are continuing this year, and they're doing beautifully. I get on Skype about once a month to teach them the Dhammapada, and a friend of mine is teaching counseling twice a month, so that they're being cared for in their Dhamma studies, even though they can't do formal Dhamma study this year. I don't know what else to tell you. It's very transitional for me. And because it's transitional for me, it's hard to enter the project in the same way. And I think that's okay. I think that's okay. At our very biggest, we were helping 600 out of 25 million AIDS patients. The help we gave has always mattered a lot. But we're not even a teaspoon, you know, flying in a bird's mouth between a mountain of fire and a drop of water. So we'll see what happens. What I know is that my staff are incredible people. And that they will take what they've learned in these years everywhere they go. Okay, that's all very general and vague, but it's a little bit of background. So now, let's see what we can do to make all this mean something here in this room. Question?
There are several questions there.
Yes, oh, please, yes.
Yeah,
oh, okay, so... Yes.
I was just wondering, if you practice in the Zen tradition,
yeah,
and in the Theravada tradition, mm-hmm, are there any types of conflicts?
At the depth, no. There are different ways of going about things. But the forms are very different. You know, I'm used to bowing on my knees. It was very hard for me after 20 years in Asia to stand with my head higher than teachers. There are divergences. There are divergences in focus. But as I re-enter active Zen practice, I feel like I am coming home without losing the middle. And my teacher is transmitted in Zen and is a Vipassana teacher. My teacher is Gil Fronsdell, and he has both lineages and has no conflicts with them. I'm sure the Puritans in both lineages would disagree with me. Yes.
Taking that you spent 15, 16 years of your life pursuing. And
make the decision, and looking back on how it's been, has it been what you thought it might be, or how has it not been?
This project was conceived in megalomania and insanity. And if I hadn't had the head of the Mary Knoll AIDS Project as my unofficial supervisor, it wouldn't have lasted a month. Okay? It was also conceived in desperation. I had spent 7 years in the West Bank and Gaza doing human rights and was in profound despair. And there was one day I was working in the Palestinian negotiations before the Oslo Agreement. I was working with the negotiating team as a specialist on family reunification and residence rights. And was, you know, there were 8 organizations. I was heading one of them, keeping families together in the face of the Israelis, trying to separate them and throw Palestinians out. And we succeeded. We kept tens of thousands of families together. But I had gone to a meeting of the Refugee Affairs Committee. They used to have these committees. And there were 5 people in the room. I was feeling self-conscious about writing policy papers when I wasn't a Palestinian. I didn't think I had any business doing it. But I was the only one in the room without another full-time job. I was the only one in the room who was able to work full-time on the crisis. 370,000 Palestinians had been deported from the Gulf. 37,000, 10%, had gotten back home. 6,000 to Gaza, 31,000 to the West Bank. These are Israeli statistics from October of 1991. And every half of those families had one or more members that could be deported as illegal aliens. And that was a huge crisis. Had anybody told me before I went to Palestine that I would be keeping families together, I would have asked if they were nuts. Yeah. I mean, you know, I never did that. I never had a family. I never, you know, I think in a way I didn't know what a family was till I went to Palestine. You know, the kind of strong, loving support that people can give each other across a wide variety of temperaments. Yeah. But it didn't matter what I cared about. It mattered what the Palestinians needed and wanted. The classic story, I know this sounds like a real divergence, but this is how I wound up doing what I've been doing. It's one of the strands. The other strands is that I lost a whole lot of people in the AIDS epidemic here. You know. And that certainly affected what I did afterwards. But where was I before that?
We were with your families in Palestine.
Yes.
And
yep. Oh, yeah. I'd gone to this refugee affairs meeting, and I got out of there. The Israelis had turned over none of the records that were necessary in order for that committee to work. That was typical, I'm afraid. And there was no way for Palestinians to have those records. You know, they had never been allowed to do a census. This had to do with who was in a specific village on a specific day in 1967. Yeah, all that kind of information. And I got out of there, and I was going down to Gaza. In those days, you could just go to Gaza. You can't anymore. And I got in the car, and I was crying and crying and crying. And halfway to Gaza, you pass this Israeli Air Force base that's got all these, you know, it seems to me like every time I passed it, there were F-16 jets taking off. And then you get to Gaza, and you've got donkey carts and unpaved roads and destitution everywhere. And so I'm there in the car crying and thinking, maybe Mother Teresa's right. Maybe the only thing you can do is comfort the dying. So that was the despair element. The megalomania, anybody who knows me knows that. It's been a constant companion.
So how did the Maryknoll connection get you to Cambodia?
I was in Cambodia already. I was in Cambodia. I'd been working. You never start a project in a foreign country until you've been in that country long enough. And that's 3 or 4 years minimum.
What were you doing there?
I went in. Oh, okay. You know, she's feeding me my lines. I was working in Thailand for the International Network of Engaged Buddhists, and I went over on the peace walk with Mahagosananda. And I don't know if you guys know who Mahagosananda is. He was the embodiment of loving kindness. Absolute embodiment of it. So I'm in Thailand. Thailand is still, in spite of everything that's happened, one of the most successful societies in the world. I'm feeling completely extraneous. We go over, we're walking along roads that still have the bomb craters from the US bombing in the 70s. These are the main roads. We're sleeping in temples that have not been cleaned since the Khmer Rouge. We've got a bunch of young monks and some old monks. We've got all these old nuns in their 70s, and they are the most determined people on the walk. They're going to bring peace to Cambodia. And then there's like about a dozen of us foreigners at the back of the walk. And I'm looking, we get up at 3 a.m, we do chanting, we hit the road. People are already there with buckets of water and branches and candles and incense and their little naked babies. The girls had skirts on, but the boys were naked. And I'm looking around, and it's destitution, and it's war damage, and it's all the warmth that is, well, that Maha embodied, and that is very much part of the undestroyed Cambodian Buddhist tradition. And I look at it and I say, it's my kind of town. So I got myself a job in a human rights agency and went over. It's been breaking my heart ever since. Yeah.
Well, that was going to be my question.
Yeah.
You went into it in Cambodia with the despair. And so, but you know, you're still seeing death and dying. Uh-huh. You're still seeing the ravages of neoliberalism. Mm-hmm. And so is what happened to the despair?
After about three good, I'm just getting fed all the good lines. I knew I should have people ask questions. The first year, Jim, my supervisor, used to say to me, you know, if it's not life-affirming for you, it's not life-affirming for the patients. And I would say, just because it's hard doesn't mean it's not life-affirming. And he would say, yeah. And he would say, you know, you can always stop. But I kind of knew that if I stopped, I wouldn't get a chance like this again. So I just sort of, you know, pigheadedly continued. And after about 3 or 4 years, there was a sea change. And my best conscious awareness of that sea change came in one of the slums we worked in, where a woman was dying. And I was doing Reiki with her. And, you know, her head was in my lap and I was working. And it wasn't me and her. It was us being held in something completely strong and completely open and bottomlessly compassionate. You know, if you ask my staff, and someone did, one of our volunteers did, how do you keep doing it? Yeah. They said, well, I mean, the amazing thing is that they were completely straightforward and honest with her. And Cambodians tend, if they don't know people well, to tell people what they think they want to hear. Poor people tend to do that in general. And, you know, Palestinians are very outspoken. It took me years to understand that I couldn't expect the same thing from Cambodians. You have to learn to listen to the silences. Anyway, but Mako, who's a Zen teacher in the San Francisco lineage and was director at Tassajara for a while, and had, you know, dropped herself down in the middle of us and was being splendid. And so she asked, went around the room with the staff and asked how they do it. The love we get. The happiness when patients do recover. The Dhamma. You know. I knew when I designed the project that we had to build in recovery time. We spend one day a week in Dhamma training. It's meditation and then a snack and then a Dhamma talk and then they practice their chanting for an hour and, you know. And then they have a retreat every year between 5 and 10 days. And especially since 2010, when the system crashed, we've also gone through these cycles of crashing and coming back and crashing and coming back. In 2014, our most beloved staff member died. Most of the staff have AIDS. He was a person of deep simplicity and humility and compassion. And it was terrible just to lose him. And so they had the Khmer New Year holiday, and we, of course, did lots of ceremonies. We do lots of ceremonies. When patients die, we chant for them. We chant for them very often as they're dying. Sometimes we're the only funeral they get, a lot of times, because that's who we're targeting. People who can afford more traditional and expensive things do. Ceremonies are tremendously important for helping to process. I don't know why that is. I was up in Cambridge 2 weeks ago, staying at my old roommate's. And he has the first floor of one of those old Cambridge houses, little one, mother-in-law house. And the second and third floor, neighbors, you know, they're not people that he's been friends with. And he went down into the basement one day and the husband had hanged himself. So I got there, not knowing it, a week afterwards, 5 days afterwards. My old roommate was just really glad that the wife had not found him. But I said, do you want me to do a ceremony down there? And he sort of shrugged and, okay. 2 days later, he came back and he said, I think it would be nice if you did that because I could tell the, after you go, I'll tell the wife that you did that. And it will matter to her. So I went down there and I did two sets of ceremonies. It's part of the answer to your question. I did the ceremonies we always do in the Theravada tradition and those chants. And then I did the Kanraman. Yeah. And I set up the Kanraman altar. And it was Enkyo who told me many years ago that you have to have a little mirror there. Because when the ghost comes and can't see itself. So I set it up. And when Norm came home, my old roommate came home, he went down the basement. And it really felt different to him. You know, I find when I do ghost ceremonies, and some years we do a lot of them, that at some point in the ceremony, I will become inexplicably happy. And people who see ghosts sort of think that's probably, I mean, my guess is that's when the ghost is going away. But since I'm a Westerner and, you know, of course, have these huge barriers to the experience, you know, this is what I get out of it. Yeah. So, you know, we treat burnout like it's some kind of, you know, hideous monster in the closet. One of my best friends in Cambodia, someone who founded a street children's organization that's now in 8 countries, used to say, if you're not burning out, you're probably not doing the work. You burn out, you come back. You burn out, you come back. And when you come back with the Dhamma, with practice, then you do come back stronger. You know, you're burning, you know, you go into the room, you go into the room and it's unbearable. And then it changes. And then you learn that you can expect the change. That doesn't mean that it doesn't smell filthy. It doesn't mean that the conditions aren't impossible. I'm talking about people chained to the bed when they can't move because they happen to be prisoners and are dying. And we had a volunteer for that person. That prisoner who was dying was ethnically Vietnamese and had he was just so far. And we were lucky enough to have a Vietnamese-American volunteer at the time who just sat with him and sang him lullabies. Yeah, because he didn't speak Khmer anymore. The Khmer part of, you know, that was, he was so far into leaving. You know, he was able to die peacefully because of her. You know, we would have done what we could, but she really got under there into his babyhood, you know. Yeah. So what happens Sometimes we say that, I mean, we always say the patients are our teachers. But, and Gil, in the first, after about 4 or 5 years when I was really sick of this and exhausted and wanted out, Gil used to say to me, you know, I wouldn't keep you there a day longer than I thought it was good for you, but you know, it is your monastery. Thanks. So he's the one who told me 2 years ago it was time to stop. That's how this process got into.
So what's up for you now? What?
Clueless.
Aren't you going to do an Ongo in San Francisco?
Yeah, I'm going to do Ongo. I wound up at Tassajara this summer because I wanted to study with Paul Haller. He's really tough. Anyway, so I'm scheduled. I couldn't stay at Tassajara because my body can't take the cold. But I'm going to do it at City Center, and Paul will be teaching. And that'll be done in March. And then I go home. And I have this fantasy that I'm going to live up and see Maria and maybe teach introductory Buddhism and meditation to the backpackers and the people who come to see Angkor Wat. And then come down once a week. If the project is still running, I can come and teach my staff. My staff, actually, this is a very, very interesting problem. Most of my staff were functionally illiterate. At the same time, they have been through the whole classic syllabus in Theravada Buddhism, the precepts, the paramis, which are 10 and are equivalent to the paramitas here, the Four Noble Truths, the Brahmaviharas, the Eightfold Path, the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, Buddha's text on meditation. I spent 2.5 years with it. The first time through, it was just learning how to read it aloud. And beginning to realize, because at that point, most of them had been meditating anywhere from 6 to 14 years, beginning to realize that the practices that the Buddha is describing are exactly what they've been doing. So I wanted them to make that connection and to know that the Buddha was talking to them. I was so pleased. Because these are people who all their life have been made to feel unworthy. They're poor. Most of them are AIDS patients. They've lost, you know, people. Every single one of them is a Khmer Rouge survivor. My staff have lived with a level of trauma that I realize I will never begin to understand. And out of that, they have created compassion. So that the guest teachers we've had for retreat have been stunned by the loving kindness and the strength of the loving kindness. So there's no way, it took me 7 years to learn how to teach them. Okay, anyway, the second time, then we went through the curriculum again as a review, and then we went, settled into the text again, this time stretching it, this time not just finding the places where they already knew what was going on, but taking other foundations of mindfulness. Because when they make the connection to experience, they are as good as anybody. So the job with them is to allow that connection to be made and to help them get through the barriers to it. Just like all of us. You know. I was sitting here in this magnificent space thinking. It's too confusing. Can't give a talk tonight.
Well, you've certainly given a good talk.
Well, it's
inspiring.
Been...
Inspiring. Very inspiring.
Well, I think the most important thing is that we are tremendously lucky. We are tremendously privileged to be able to give our hearts in this way. And to have that practice sustained. And all of us know that. You know, that sometimes I say it's like we're using the patience to train ourselves in Dhamma. That sounds a little bit crasser than it actually is. But, you know, they really are. You go into the room and all your resistance comes up. Every bit of it. You know, here's this person chained to a naked bed, or not chained to a naked bed, or in a diaper in the early years that nobody had changed in 4 days. Or you don't want to hear it. But you go in there and you just don't want to do it. And seeing that, seeing that is the beginning of letting it go. And when you let it go, it's still filthy. You know, it's still awful. There still aren't the necessary medicines, and there really aren't again. But in the middle of that, it is profoundly okay. Which doesn't mean it doesn't need to be addressed. It just means that something else is the ground between you. And not between you, the ground holding you. And I guess what worries me about giving it all up is, where am I going to get my grounding? And the answer is, I'm supposed to find groundlessness, right? You know, it's been a wonderful privilege for a very long time. And yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Are there more questions? We've got probably time. Yeah. Oh, wait, you didn't have one yet, so.
Just wondering, in terms of working with people who are terminally ill, what seems to help them the most, or is it changes from individual to individual in terms of dharma practice?
Well, we have these standard things we do. You know, we do Reiki, we do traditional wat chanting, we do, you know, massage, we talk to people, we do all those things. But we're establishing intimacy. The job has many, many, many faces. But just to put it in your own teacher's words, you know, that we're becoming intimate with people. And that intimacy is not an intimacy of personality, although it works through the personality. It's an intimacy of Dhamma. It's something much larger than the individuals. Yeah. Does that help? Yeah. But, you know, I mean, people are different, so we do it differently. My staff is better than I am in the long run because they're Cambodian, they're inside. Most of them have AIDS, you know. They know it in a way I never will. And they've been selected because they had the heart. Yeah. Okay. More questions? No. Oh. Yep.
I was just wondering, how do you not get angry in the face of such evil? Because I have a friend who lives there, and he posts every week, every day, online, and it's, you know, more poor people being kicked out of their land, no compensation, and more labor. Workers striking and their leaders get murdered.
Sound like any other country you know?
I'm sorry.
Does it sound like any other country you know?
I just get angry reading that every day.
Well, my problem actually, especially being here as long a time as I am right now, is how to get back away, get beyond being angry at America. I mean, we need to, I mean, in Cambodia, it's kind of simple, that what we do is focus our energies on what we can do and let our hearts be broken again and again and again and again and again. You know, I don't want to go into the corruption we face in the hospitals. We find the people we can work with and we work with them. So rather than anger, you know, there's a lot of sorrow. You know, I was reading in the Phnom Penh Post 2 days ago about this, you know, they round up the beggars in the street and they dump them into this place which is just hideous, and several people have died there in the last couple of weeks. One apparently from a beating, and two more. You know, people don't get medical treatment, and they were very sick, and they got taken away someplace. But they just dump people in there, and then they're subject to all kinds of abuse, and they've now made it so they can't get out of there. And what occurred to me is that when I go back, I'll probably spend some time with the human rights organization that I worked with in the beginning, because they're very, very, very good at finding strategies. They're very good at finding effective aid and effective help. Any place you go, you know, I think what you're getting partly is that when Americans tell me how corrupt Cambodia is, you know, Cambodian corruption is not enshrined in law, although you have plenty of corruption that, you know, goes beyond that. You know, when we registered our office, I put $600 in an envelope, and that went with the paperwork to the Ministry of the Interior, right? When I registered the office in America, I wrote a check for $850, and that got sent with the papers, and it went to the U.S. government. You tell me the difference. I got my Cambodian papers a lot faster. And Cambodia isn't making war all over the world. And my carbon footprint in Cambodia is about a 500th, maybe a 1,000th of the necessary carbon footprint because of the structures that exist here. So it's worth not being too, and also, you know, you hear about this stuff and you get angry, but when you live in a place, things are more modulated. What I did this summer at Tassajara that was really a lovely exercise for me was I tried to suspend my judgment about the stuff that I saw. Right? And just, you know, not see it. But instead of dwelling on how idiotic some things were, I just like tried to see what else was there. How is it that people can have such completely bizarre and insane ideas? Did you hear the Republican debate? I rest my case. Before I went to Thailand, I thought it was all about prostitutes. You go to Thailand, they have an education system that works. They have a minimum wage that supports people. They have effective public transportation. They have medical care that's affordable, and their private medical care is world class. I had my 70th birthday physical at what's ranked one of the 10 best hospitals in the world in Bangkok, Bumrungrad. All right. I had any test you want to name. I didn't get a CAT scan. I didn't get a CAT scan or an MRI. All right. Do you know how much it cost me? No insurance, just plain walk in there and get it. $549.
American dollars?
Yep. I couldn't get an aspirin for that. But you don't hear about that. Huh? So we get decontextualized stuff. Yeah. I was always furious in Palestine, because partly because of what was going on, partly because I felt implicated as someone who was raised Jewish and raised Zionist. I felt like I was personally responsible in a way that, you know, as I used to say, as an American, I can go anywhere to repent, but as somebody raised Zionist, you know. And also because anger is a much more accepted part of the society. Palestinians are direct and outspoken. You know, Cambodian anger is different. It's more, it's different. So, I almost died of anger in Palestine. My asthma got out of control. I couldn't breathe. I came back to the States on emergency sick leave and I started crying, and then I started being able to breathe. We can't afford anger. You know, Gandhi said we cook it into satyagraha. We cook it into, you know, the Tibetans talk about transforming it into the energy for action. But it's very important that it be cooked. It's very important that it become pure of ego. Because as long as it's connected to ego, as long as it's connected to our ideas, as long as it's connected with our being right, then it's going to be toxic to everything around it. So yeah, that's how I keep from getting angry. Yep.
So when you talk about cooking anger and despair, can you say a little more about
Well, what we do in Vipassana, sorry, you know, something comes up. And we turn our attention not to the story, not to the narrative. We turn the attention to the physical experience of that in the body. So instead of running through my head how badly they mistreat the people in Presbyt, the place where they put the beggars, you know, it's like, okay, where am I feeling that right now? Where in my body? What does it feel like? Is it warm? Is it cold? Is it steady? Does it move? Is it stronger when I inhale? Is it stronger when I exhale? We investigate the experience of it. And eventually, it changes because everything changes. And we get to be very intimate with our anger. I mostly have reactive anger. Reactive anger is the most common and probably the least useful type. It's you get angry because you're scared. So for me, you know, I look at the anger. And then the fear gets a chance to be heard. And then I look at the fear. And then the hurt that's underneath gets a chance to be heard. And by the time I go back to the story, I'm in a very different place with it. And I can deal with it more calmly. Much more calmly than I just did right now in going into the America riff. I didn't mean to be quite as aggressive about America. Okay, well, it's past 7:30, so... Are we ready?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.